Tom Ruby, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Morning, Adam. I've been a follower of yours since you guys started the project. I love what you guys are doing out in the Diocese of Tulsa, building a strong core and then growing out from there. I really love it. Annual meetings, growing your network, and talking to good people.
Yeah, man, I gotta give you a little bit of affirmation here. Just, and this is unsolicited, obviously, but a lot of the listeners of our show know that I moved out into about 10 acres of land about 7-8 months ago, and I posted it on X, and at the time you and I had kind of been cordial back and forth, you know, talking and hanging out just on that platform, because there's a lot of overlap of things that we like, and you reached out to me and said, "Hey, I'd love to talk to you, love to help you." And I said, "Oh, okay, cool." And I was really moved by that. You reached out to me, and you know, you've been a man of the land, so to speak, for some time. And you took the time to kind of reach out and just say, "Hey, just want to be available, want to be a resource, want to help." And I found that to be very endearing. It was something that, you know, I wish that a lot more people would do. So I appreciate it. I'm grateful for you reaching out, and grateful for the conversation today.
Thanks. That's really reaffirming. I had the good fortune and blessings to be mentored by some really, really good men in my younger professional days. And I made it a core promise of mine that I would continue to do that until I couldn't do it anymore. And that means hopefully until the day I die. And so I offer that out. It's something that you can't force on anybody, but it is something that you can offer. And presence and intentionality, if you can just be there for somebody, are far more efficacious and powerful than most people think about or even understand. Understand or think about even. Mm-hmm. So over the last 12 years, I've never turned anybody down that's written me out of the blue saying, "Hey, you know, would you mentor me?" And some of those, you know, last for a few weeks or for a few months, and then some last for years and become long friendships. And when you said that you were thinking about buying some land, I had forgotten all about that until you just reminded me that I reached out and asked you what you're going to do and offered some ideas about, you know, planting trees and reforestation. And I think, if I remember correctly, maybe I even offered that you, within 10 acres, you have more than enough land to think about in certain zones, like create little, mm-hmm. you know, patches and zones to break it apart.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it is, it is very, when you buy land, you get, and obviously 10 acres isn't a whole lot, but you kind of have a freezing moment of, "I'm not sure what to do. I don't want to mess up," mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm, and so, like, mm-hmm. It's kind of paralyzing because, you know, you have it now. There's a lot of options that you can have, but you don't want to do all of them. It's almost like you can do anything you want, but you can't do everything. So what is it that you're going to do? And what is you going to do today? And so to have that kind of mentorship of saying, like, and have you kind of relay, "Here's what I would do if I were you," was very helpful. In fact, we have quite a few fruit trees out there now. We have quite a few persimmons and walnut, and we have all sorts of different trees out there now. Now it's been very, very cold here in Oklahoma recently, and so we've been trying to keep the trees alive because they're still pretty young. But yeah, it was very, very helpful. And it's something that, you know, there's so many bad things that happen that you hear about on social media platforms, right? Especially X or Facebook or whatever. You hear all the negativity, but, you know, I would have been able to have the conversation today. Wouldn't be able to have the conversation 6 months ago and kind of talk to you and pick your brain if it wasn't for the X, you know, the platform. So, and being able to connect, that, which is really cool.
Well, a couple thoughts on that. First, it doesn't necessarily have to be the hellhole that some people make it. You are not under no obligation to go down those doom rabbit holes. Mm-hmm. And you can make use of it for making new friends, for meeting mutuals, for actually getting people together that wouldn't otherwise do so. I mean, my friend Alan Cornett does this about once a month. He has a bluegrass pub night where he just announces, hey, we're going to get together. And Twitter followers, X followers, just meet up, because you can just do that.
Yeah.
Now, with respect to the land, I find it's just really interesting. You said something that's really great, and I use this in my when I do seminars, whenever I give presentations, when we talk to our guests on cultural debris excursions, I say, what can't you do? Everything. When we took my son and daughter-in-law to Italy a few years back as their wedding gift, they said, hey, we want to go to the Holy House of Loreto. And I said, that's great. I think you guys should do that. And they said, no, I mean, all of us. I go, nope, we can't do that. And they said, Dad, it's the Holy House of Loreto. I said, what can't we do on this trip, buddy?
Yeah.
And he says, everything? I said, yep. And when can't we do it? He goes, all at once? I go, that's right. So we're going to have to pick the things that we're going to do, and we're going to have to do them thoughtfully and deliberately. Now, with respect to the land, you know, I'm very, very careful not to tell people, I think you should do this, 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 and this with your land. What I always say is, look, first of all, look at your land. Nature will expose itself, you know, and, mm-hmm. and tell you what's there and what's not. Or, you know, almost no land is ever perfectly flat. All right.
Right. Yeah.
The land moves, the land undulates. There are natural drainages in the land. You may have a northern exposure or a southern exposure. You may have some woods in some places. You know, so the first thing I tell people is to walk around and look at it, like really, really walk around, get to know all parts of it. Even prairie, even the great plains and the tall grass prairie of the central part of the United States, without large ruminant herds like the buffalo, they will grow back to forest. The forest will eventually retake it. So your 10 acres probably has some undulation in it, probably has some places where there are some trees already. And if they're not, then you actually get to really be creative. And if there are, well, then that tells you what's natural there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost like you get to, it's kind of your canvas now. You get to paint it. Mm-hmm. I find it's interesting that, and I live in a, like, fair warning, Tom, like, I live in a very bubble. Like, I live, mm-hmm. like, I live in this bubble that we've created and mm-hmm. that I love. And I really like that. That's the kind of the thing in which that I feel like I can make the most impact, mm-hmm. Living in my bubble. But it seems like that there are a lot of people, specifically younger people, who desire to go back to the land, to have a little piece, you know, maybe it's just even a quarter acre, or, you know, maybe it's 100 acres, but to kind of get out of the urban areas and to get back to the land. Why do you think that is?
When we moved here, I met early on, very, very, the second person I met after my state forester was my horticultural extension agent, Alexis. And she was wearing a t-shirt the first day that I met her. And it says, God first created the garden and then he created the gardener. Mm. And I think that there's really something to that. We were created to be in communion with the garden. The garden is our natural habitat, I think, for man. Okay. Man also creates cities, and even then they don't have to be hellholes. Okay.
All right.
You can take elements of the garden and put them there. But I think deep down, we all know that there's truth, and we all know that there's objective truth. And we have this yearning inside that tells us these things. Okay. So we know that we should walk in nature. We know that we should be close to nature. We know that we should revere nature's creator and commune with that. So I do think that there is that longing inside of everybody. And the more disconnected people become from each other and atomized, I think that the more they long for something that's real. And they look at these pictures, and it's very interesting. One of our, I'm sure that he's a mutual to both of us, somebody that tweets at A Time to Keep, posts these beautiful pictures, these painting renditions of nature in the Shire. And I made a comment yesterday that the beauty in those, the man-made and in those pictures didn't come from the picture. The idea didn't precede, you know, the actual construction. The picture followed from that. Okay. Somebody saw something that was beautiful and painted it. If you see pictures from people's heads that are in people's minds, there's rarely a city in it. It's usually nature. There's never power lines. Mm-hmm. There's not roads. There may be fences, rarely, but what mm-hmm. people, but what people see in their minds and hearts, they actually have an idea of nature, even if they've rarely been in it. I don't know if that makes sense. It's a yearning inside mm-hmm. of us. It tells us the truth.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's right. And I think you touched on something that I've been really contemplating recently. I hesitate to bring it up because my thoughts aren't completely in line, but I think it's important, is that there is something to be said about realism and cultivating wonder and being able to cultivate the imagination, how the land and nature help man to cultivate his imagination, cultivate wonder and awe. And in a world today that is deprived, there's such depravity in imagination and creativity, in stillness, in solitude. There's something
just
about
observation. Okay. You can't have an imagination must necessarily, let's go ahead and explore this and expand your ideas. I love this. Okay. Imaginations must necessarily be based on some foundational mound of information that we have, experience. Okay. Kids cannot imagine beyond. So think about little babies. They can't imagine beyond that which they have experienced. Okay. Mm-hmm. So their imagination grows. The first thing kids dream about is eating. That's the first thing that they dream about is eating or the faces of their parents. Okay. Kids can't dream about things that they haven't seen. They can't imagine things that they haven't seen. We are today developing generations that can't imagine beyond a very, very narrow scope of experiences. And as people travel less and as people are more insulated, they can't necessarily imagine because they don't have anything to imagine. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so I am, we always open, We always have standing invitations for friends to come visit. We have standing invitations for any mentees to come visit us, okay, to walk on the farm. I've had mutuals that have come here from across the country just to walk on the trails and to look at the creeks, okay, because they see the pictures and they say, I want to feel that. I want to experience that, okay? They have probably places that are a lot closer to them that they can go, but they want to do it with somebody. Does that make sense? So there are multiple truths that naturally flow from natural consequences from what you're talking about right here. They want to commune with nature, and they want to commune with somebody else. We were made for communion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We were made for relationship. The fact that we're made in God's image and God is a relationship, okay? We were made for that, and we were made to commune with creation. So I think that there's a very, very strong sense to what you're talking about there. You know, people have this desire, especially young people. My family were peasants from Serbia, land peasants. When we escaped and came to the U.S., I grew up in the city. I grew up in the city. Mm-hmm. All that I longed for was to leave. All I cared about was to get out of the city. Like on birthdays, I wanted to go out in the country. When I got old enough to drive, my friends and I would drive out of Simi Valley through Fillmore and Santa Paula and that district where there was wild oak, or, you know, wild oak trees and orange orchards, where today Thomas Aquinas College is. You know, we would drive through that area because it was beautiful and it wasn't the city. Mm-hmm. We longed for that. We longed to get out and play in what we had seen in books. I think that that's natural that you're talking about that.
Yeah. And I also find that, you know, and I'm new to having land. And so, you know, I hesitate to say, here's what I've learned thus far, you know, being a guy who's barely had any time. But I do find that there's natural virtues that you have to have when you have land. There are things that are naturally coming about that I'm trying to teach my sons while having land, right? So that the idea of being diligent, the idea of perseverance, of starting a project and seeing it to completion, this idea of hard, you know, of hard work, of manual labor, land gives you a kind of a natural, making an apology, and I mean this is like a defense of manual labor. Mm-hmm. That there's this satisfaction, and I wonder if, because we have kind of gone away from the land that a lot of people have, that these natural virtues aren't cultivated as easily in man, which we know, you know, supernatural builds upon natural, that grace perfects nature. Mm-hmm. That I wonder if we ran away from the land for something that is supposed to be better, bigger and better, with taller skyscrapers and office jobs and money and all this stuff. Yet we have lost maybe an idea of what some of these natural virtues are that are needed for man to lead his family, to be a man of God, a man pursuing God.
I think that there's something to be said about that. When man started gathering together in villages and towns, there was still a connection to the land, even for multiple generations. Okay, so for example, in Serbia, everybody knows where their village is. Everybody knows their village. It doesn't matter how many generations you are removed from working the soil. When people greet each other, they say, well, Dakle si seli, where are you from? Where's your village from? What's your village? And they can tell where their village is. not region, village. Okay. And when man gathered in villages, they were still tied to the land because of the seasons and what was produced and when. And it forced the patience. It's something that you're teaching your sons. It's something that I taught my kids here to observe. Okay. Not to try to control first, but to observe first. Okay. If we try first to just put things in some place and force it, it may backfire on us. The things that we plant may die. Okay. We may not understand why until we see, you know, when the floods come. So first we must observe. Second, we must, and in that observation, we're learning things. Okay. Today we're removed from that. We're removed from that cycle of seasons. We're removed from that cycle of growth, from that time, from the time that it takes from when you plant a plant until it's actually bearing fruit, because it's not instantaneous, right? Mm-hmm. There's no teleporter. And we learn that certain trees fruit early, okay, and then certain trees fruit late. My sour cherries, my Montmorency cherries, they're always the first, okay, and then the plums, and they come in succession of the various kinds of plums, then the apples and the pears, and they come even after the hazelnuts, okay, and then the walnuts are the last, and even when they fall to the ground, you have to wait until their husks, you know, rot away, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's something there about living in that time that we have to slow down and recognize that. And we lose that today when we can buy frozen blueberries. We lose that today.
Any time of the year.
That's correct. And so now, listen, I'm not being hypocritical when I say I like having tomatoes in the wintertime.
Right. Yeah.
Okay? But because I grow tomatoes, I also know when they're available and when they're not. Okay. So I can tomatoes in the summer, and I make sauces, and we have, I don't know, we sometimes 25, 30 quarts of tomato sauces and juices. Last year we probably canned 12 quarts of apple butter and pear butter and apple pear butter.
Awesome.
And, you know, so that we can have that in the winter and into the next spring and late into the next summer before they're ready to pick. And we're giving thanks that whole time. Okay. Mm-hmm. For the ability to do that. Okay. There's something about eating your food that you preserved the previous year, late into the next season, that gives you an appreciation for the seasons and how it was done, more so than just going to buy a can on the shelf.
Sure. Yeah. Now, and I also want to caveat here as we have this discussion that I'm not saying that you can't develop natural virtues in the city. I'm not saying there's not like things in which you can learn living in the urban areas or in the city. That's not what I'm saying. It's just not an either or thing. This is a both and. There's just some differences that you can learn, but that doesn't make, you know, this one better than this one, or, you know, there's just difference.
So I'll give you an example of that. Rosa is a friend of mine in Genoa. She runs a small gelateria, and I've eaten at a lot of gelaterias across Italy and across Europe. Okay. And I think she makes the best gelato probably anywhere that I've ever tasted. She gets sent by the EU to teach people in other countries how to make gelato. Okay. Here's where Rosa ties into the land in the middle of a city. She has a small, tiny little shop. Okay. She has one little freezer with eight gelatos in it. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't have 50 flavors. She doesn't have 150 flavors like the gelateria that opposes the Pantheon. You know, it's on the corner uphill from the Pantheon in Rome when you're looking down. Okay. That gelateria is like eye candy. Okay. You go in there, you know, you're going to pay more. You're probably flavoring everything with syrups. Okay. Mm-hmm. So Rosa says to me, Toma, you know what everybody wants from me? Fragola. You know what I'm not going to have in the wintertime? Fragola. Fragola is strawberries, okay? She says, because I'm not going to pay to have them flown in here from Peru, okay? I'm going to do things that are in season that are available to me, okay, that I can make. So she says, when the people that live at the top of her building that are growing kiwis, okay, when their kiwis come into bloom and they give her a big bucket of kiwis, she says, don't tell the state. Okay. I make kiwi and it lasts me for a few days. Okay. Mm-hmm. So when my friend Angelo from Ovada gave me a 5-pound bag of almonds from his orchard up there, and I took them to Rosa, she made almond gelato for days afterwards with that.
Sure. Okay? Yeah.
And so she's in the city and she's teaching her customers about that virtue of patience.
Yeah. Yeah. I just want to make sure we said that, because I could hear you're screaming right at the video, like saying like, but what about me? You know, that's
no,
not
you're right.
That's what I just wanted to make sure. One of the things though, I do find, Tom, is to go back to this, you can do anything, but you can't do everything, saying, is that because I'm what I would call probably like a very amateur hobby homesteader, right? I'm not a full-time homesteader. I still go to the grocery store. Mm-hmm. That I find that I can't do everything, that I actually need other people. Mm-hmm. I need, like you said, that we are made for communion. And one of the things that I've found living out on this land is that, like, okay, I can do something really well. I can grow this vegetable, or I can raise these pigs, or have these cows on my land. But I can't do all of it. And so one of the things that we, you know, used to have as a society was this natural need for others, mm-hmm. this natural need for neighbor. Because listen, I'll do all the strawberries or all the tomatoes or whatever, but I also would like pork. So I need you to do all the pork, and I need candles, and I don't have time to do the candles. I need you to do the candles. And then we can all trade and barter. And then that way we all have things. Do you find that we've lost maybe a sense of need for neighbor because we don't need everything from people?
Yeah. I mean, I really do. I think that we've lost this sense. And at the same time, I think social media has heightened this. Not only have we felt that we don't need the neighbors because we can go buy anything that we want to, okay, and have it delivered to our house. We don't even have to go to the store anymore. But we have not only an imperfect, but a lie, and not only an imperfect picture of what a homestead or a cottage looks like, but now we have cottage core, which tells your wife what she should look like, okay, and what dress she should wear if she really wants to be a trad, you know, cottage core housewife, right? That's all a lie, okay, mm-hmm. Because almost nobody can be self-sufficient today. And you're right, you can't do everything. So you have to pick something. I'm never going to grow my own wheat here. Okay. I'm never going to grow my own corn here. But what I am going to do is I'm going to reforest the land. That's what we decided to do because we can't do everything. So we're mm-hmm. going to reforest the land, and we're going to be very deliberate about how we reforest it and for what purposes, so that we can have a food forest, so that we can have nuts. We are going to be the anchor piece of land for the regeneration of chestnuts in this biome, okay, in this bioregion. We got 25 North American chestnuts that are blight resistant now, that are growing here on the farm, because that's what I could afford.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all growing well. And it's going to be, you know, 20 years before they're just spewing out a lot of nuts, but then those are going to start to spread. And the number of oaks that we're up to 77 different species of trees on 15 and a half acres here.
Wow.
Okay. And so we're moving fruit trees out into what we call the meadow, which was hayed pasture when we bought the land, and it's been reforested. So we're moving fruit trees and nuts from our woods. And like you said, you can't do everything, so you have to pick something. So we planted a small orchard, and we're reforesting, and we're trying to regenerate streams now so that our creeks run year round. What used to be seasonal runoff, you know, in the spring, we now have creeks that are running year round in just 12 years from reforestation. And that's what we can do. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I'll accept that we'll give away all the fruit to, we have a standing every year, you know, deal with our neighbors on our, you know, 2 miles of, you know, winding road up along the knob here. Anybody can come pick fruit from the orchard at any time without permission. Just come get it. Okay. And because we can't even eat it all. And the rest feeds the deer. And then we eat the deer. Makes sense.
Right. Yeah. So.
And I'll go buy flour and vegetables from the local market, from other neighbors. And in turn, you know, we'll give, you know, canned food. But you're right, you can't do everything. So you have to pick something and pick something that you like, pick something that you're going to enjoy doing. Because on 10 acres, you won't be able to be self-sufficient. You know, it doesn't matter how good your garden plan is. You just won't have enough calories to feed your family for the year. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you have to have this kind of goes back into what I would really like to talk about with you today is I started the conversation talking about living in my little bubble where I felt like that I could make the most impact and the need for neighbor. And so I really want to talk about, you know, subsidiarity and localism.
Oh, I love it.
You know, and the need for localism and how, you know, at one point, Tom, I feel like that we want to be magnanimous, which is always a good thing. Like we want to do great things and we want to do big things, which is good. That's a good thing. But I think sometimes there's a temptation to say, I want to do big, great things out there, but not here in my home or not here with my neighbors or not here within my parish or my diocese, but I want to do this nationwide or worldwide or whatever, you know, like, do you see what I'm saying? Where there's maybe disorder of,
there is a disorder. Everybody wants to be the great man of history. So these, I don't know, these amateur historians that read about that read a book and they see the term great man, they want to be the great man of history. Nobody wants to be the person that just maintains the bloodline going forward for generation after generation after generation, so that in God's providence, in time, somebody from your line may be picked out to be the great man when necessary. Okay. Mm-hmm. You can't say I'm going to be the great man for my generation. You got to do the best that you can do in what situation that you were, what you were put in there. And that's in community and that is locally. So you have to be the best spouse that you can be, husband or wife. Okay. And you got to do your best and you're not going to be great. Okay. But you got to do your best and you got to be deliberate about it. And then you got to be a good sibling and son or daughter to your parents. Okay. And then you have to be a good neighbor to your neighbors. Right before we went on this morning, I heard the noise outside, and here's Darren Farr, lives a half mile down the road. He's the second house for me, half mile down the road, and he's plowing out my driveway. I got a 1,200 foot long driveway, 5-inch snow drifts this morning, and he's out there plowing me out this morning. He's being a good neighbor. Okay. Mm. When my sister and her husband were visiting this past weekend, we had them and another couple over, and we tried to be good neighbors, you know, to expand those circles. And so, you know, you subsidiarity is very, very important. You know, don't ask for help outside your family for what you ought to be doing, first of all. Okay. So, you know, you are first and foremost, your kids' parents. So don't expect somebody else to raise your kids. Somebody else can help you and watch your kids for you when you need that. But you know, you have that responsibility, and then don't cede that responsibility to somebody else. Within your community, you know, don't ask for help outside of your parish for what you can do in parish, and don't ask for permission to do your job. Okay. You don't have to ask the diocese permission to feed the poor. You don't have to ask the city's permission to, you know, to have a coat closet in your parish. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And then do things, you know, resist the state telling you what to do in your own local community. Okay. Mm-hmm. If mm-hmm. you know, what's good for your community. So if somebody from out of your community is coming in and wants to put up a, you know, 1,000-acre solar farm in your, I refuse to even acknowledge that the term farm, I call it a solar array because it's not a farm.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And if somebody wants to do that in your area, and ask the question, is the power that's generated going to stay here in my community? And almost 100% of the time, it's not. It's going to go to somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And who's going to bear the cost of, you know, when the, you know, in the county next to us, they stripped all the topsoil. Okay. And they sold it because that's what's worth something. And then they sunk 450 acres of solar panels with concrete and steel into the ground, and then put gravel over the top of that, and then sprayed some grass that kind of takes in jankily into the gravel. But they had to build 32 retention ponds in 450 acres. Why is that? Well, because now the water doesn't soak into the ground like it used to.
Mm.
Okay. So when it rains, the water runs off. Okay. Mm. So this is a local community giving up subsidiarity to somebody else for somebody else's benefit, and they're covering the costs to themselves. Subsidiarity works in two directions, not just one.
Yeah, that's a good point. So how do you define, like, you hear the word localism, you hear that, especially, like, you know, G.K. Chesterton and mm-hmm. Hilaire Belloc and all those guys that, you know, they kind of maybe reignited this idea that previous popes had talked about. And, you know, this is not something that's like, hey, this is new to the 21st century. This is something that as Catholics we've talked about for years and years and years. But how would you define localism? Like, what does that really mean?
Well, I mean, distributism is the idea of, you know, localism is the term that the Chesterton Society wants to use to move away from the term distributism, because distributism was being the concept of distributism was actually being taken by opponents of it to say, oh, you're socialist, you want to redistribute wealth. And no, distributism is the widespread distribution of the means of making a living. So whether it's in Chesterton's mind, in Hilaire Belloc's mind, in Pope Pius the Ninth's mind, I think, in Father Vincent McNabb's mind, it was owning your land and owning a small business in a village. okay, in whatever community you lived in, the widespread distribution of the means to make a living for your own family. That's what that meant. That's what distributism is. And it's based upon the principle of subsidiarity, that the state shouldn't do anything, shouldn't tell the community to do anything that the community can't take care of itself, and that the community doesn't tell the family to do anything that the family can't take care of itself. And so when you have a widespread distribution of the means to make a living, you naturally, it brings communities together for what you were talking about earlier, because everybody can't do everything. Everybody does something to contribute. Okay. Whether it's hiring somebody at a living wage. Okay. Whether it's working your own land, okay, or even, you know, gathering, that's what distributism is. That's what localism is. It forces you to live at a local level. Today, we live globally, and in a true globalist system, everything is so interconnected and everything is so just in time, that the entire system is very, very fragile. Okay. Extremely fragile. And so we build these systems for efficiency, and that becomes, availability and efficiency become our gods. Okay. Rather than the land and the cycles of the season that God actually gave us and created us to work on and with. So this idea of localism means that you get to know your neighbor, okay, and you get to love your neighbor. If you think about, I mean, let's imagine a medieval village. Let's imagine, you know, in the 1600s, at the end of the 30 Years' War, okay. You have this, you have farmers, you have a parish, you have a blacksmith in town, you have a local healing woman that knows her herbs, right? People are growing chickens, people are raising chickens in their, and there's not a grid pattern on the streets, right? You know, people have homes that are in proximity to each other, and then there's, and then they go out and work land holdings. Okay. It may be that the blacksmith is a real jackass, right? It really may be that he's got a really bad personality. Mm-hmm. But at some level you have to deal with him because he's the blacksmith, right?
Right.
But if he is so much of a jack wagon that people don't want to have to deal with them anymore, they'll go find another blacksmith from another community and bring him in there. Right. Mm-hmm. And then that guy will lose his means of making a living. And so he has to temper himself. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Today, there's no tempering mechanism. And in fact, we are encouraged to not temper ourselves. We are encouraged to take extreme positions and to moderate our own positions to the extreme from which we, like, I am asked every now and then by friends, but what about the murders in Chicago? Because they want to talk about some politician. And I go, I don't want to talk about the politician. I'm just not interested. It has nothing to do with me. But what about the murder rate in Chicago? And I say, do you live in Chicago? No. Why do you care? Because it's indicative of what's happening to society. I said, you didn't care in the 70s when there were bombings across this country, when there were hijackings. You didn't say that was indicative of a collapse of society. But today, suddenly, we have this collapse in society, right? You know, but localism, on the other hand, makes you see the person that's your neighbor. And here, let me give you a quote from Father Spencer Howe. I gave a localism talk at the Chesterton Conference a couple of summers ago. Mm-hmm. And And somebody said to me, "You hang out with lesbians? How can you do that?" And I said, "Well, they're my neighbors. So when we have potlucks, we have them over." Okay.
Right. Yeah.
So that's why. And he goes, "I don't get it." And Father Howe turns around and says, "Because they're not a placeholder for an ideology." Okay. Mm. So when you see your neighbors as neighbor, what does Bishop Barron constantly say? Love is willing the good of the other as other. Okay. Mm-hmm. So you can't wish somebody's good and their best well-being if you don't actually love them first.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. And I mean, I feel like that's this order that is desperately needed. Like, this globalism creates chaos, in my opinion. It, you know, Aquinas talks about how peace is the tranquility of order.
Amen. Amen.
You know, and so if peace is the tranquility of order, then if you want peace, then you need to have order in your home. You want peace, you need to have order in your community. You want peace, and you just, the concentric circles, so to speak, that, you know, it grows out. And so I can't worry about the people, you know, across the ocean, although I love them as a neighbor. You know, I love them as a, you know, as a Christian man, I love them and I will, they're good, but I can't worry about them.
That's right.
While taking care of my family, because if I'm worrying about them and I'm putting blinders on around the people that I actually am called to have an influence in my life, their chaos will actually lose my peace. My peace ends up like getting broken because I'm concerned about something that I cannot do anything about.
Well, it can be a both and, okay? There is a possibility that it can be a both and, okay? As long as what's going on overseas doesn't prevent you from loving your family and helping your neighbor, mm-hmm. then giving that some attention, if you have the means to do that, to give it some attention, mm-hmm. and to give it some assistance, then by all means, do so. But as long as you're not doing that at the expense of those closest to you,
right. That's okay. A better way of saying it.
Sure. And yeah. And so what I'm very interested in is when I hear people say we should build walls instead of bridges, I start to get a little cringy, okay? When I hear obviously devout Catholics saying, no, we need separation from the world, not, you know, building bridges, because that... You know, am I going to build walls to separate me from my neighbors? Like, I don't care how often you go to mass. If your neighbors can't stand you, okay, mm-hmm. then you know, I kind of question how much of that's taking root in life.
Mm.
You know, okay, it's not an either or. It can be a both and. Okay, you can be very devout. You can go to holy hour. Okay. But if you go to holy hour and you don't love your neighbor, okay, mm-hmm. And you're not helping your neighbor,
Yeah, okay. So I think that's a strong point and one that I wanted to bring up because I feel like that localism actually is a fertile ground, so to speak, for evangelization.
Yes. Glad you said that.
Yeah, because you know, I find that evangelizing, like, is much easier if you just share life with one another. That if you just say, look, I have these goods, come share them with me. Come be a part of this. And when I say, because some of the goods that I have been just a complete gift from God. It's not something that I did. It's not something that I, you know, like I created or anything like that. It's a complete gift to me. And so what is it as Christians we're called to when given gifts is to share them with others. And so I find that evangelization is much easier if we just share life with one another.
You're so spot on. My neighbor that came and plowed me out this morning, he was going to plow out somebody else. And he said at one point about some people on the knob that are... that don't identify religiously with us. He said, at the very least, they'll never be able to say that they didn't ever meet a Christian that wasn't kind to them and loved them. Mm. Okay. They'll never be able to say that. Okay. They may be able to say, well, I met this person that, that calls himself a Christian and they were really mean to me, but that one didn't. Okay. Mm-hmm. That one loved us. Okay. Now, didn't validate us, but loved us.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's, you know, in, it's what I call guerrilla evangelization. Okay. Living your life, loving your neighbor, living the Beatitudes, living the corporal works of mercy. Okay. That's guerrilla evangelization. You will evangelize if you just live your life that way. Okay. Mm-hmm. But if you're going out and hammering on people and they won't listen to you, you know, they won't listen to you because they don't believe that you love God if you won't love them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and a lot of these people have never experienced the love of a father before.
They haven't.
And so how, you know, you may be the only Bible they read.
That's correct.
So to speak.
That's very well said.
And that's our job as Christians is to share that love of the Father with others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. They don't need, so like when they walk into my house, there's no question when they walk into my house, what we believe. Okay. Mm-hmm. We don't have to put a sign out front. We, in this house, we believe. They see right. how they see in this house how we treat people, or they see how we don't.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I mean, your family could be the one homily that your neighbors hear.
Mm-hmm. That's
how,
right.
How your family, you know, man,
You ought to really post that today. I'm going to post that. Your family may be the only homily that your neighbors ever hear.
Yeah.
What you should do then is constantly expand that circle.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Of neighbor. Expand what that circle of neighbor is. Okay. And then help others do the same thing in their neighborhoods. Help others do the same thing in their village. Be an example for other people that aren't living next to you in other places around the country. Use your social media for that purpose, to help other people build those bonds of neighborhood and fellowship and being the homily for their neighbors.
Yeah.
It can be done. Okay. There's a mutual that lives in Lexington that wants to build a stone chapel out here on the farm. And it may happen someday, may not. Okay. But he wants to do that. And he's like, we can have masses out there. I go, well, it'll be a little bit more difficult than that, but it could be possible. We can make it an oratory. I mean, we can ask the bishop to make it an oratory. And, you know, he's like, okay, great. I want to do that. I'm like, great. Yeah.
Yeah.
but I'm glad. So we're bringing people from farther away into that circle, but, you know, figure out, you know, make your home a place that people want to come to, build a place that people want to come learn from and be eager to learn from others to take the good that other people have to offer you, you know? It's stunning what our neighbors do here for each other. They give each other manure from their horses. Last spring, one of our neighbors got several, you know, yards of mulch delivered, and he says, hey, I got way too much. Anybody can come get whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as I said, Darren's out plowing people's yards. He's not asking for anything, and he doesn't even stick around to knock on the door to say, hey, look what I did. You just get it, you know?
Yeah.
And it happens, you know, people look out for each other, and people bring in each other's mail. People don't lock their doors. I mean, that's when you know that you've really built localism. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're living localism.
Tom, it seems like that you really understand the need of and the virtue of hospitality. Can you just maybe talk about what hospitality really looks like and how that plays a role in both localism and evangelization?
I think, you know, we're told several times in the New Testament, especially about hospitality, and we're given examples of it in the Old Testament, right? With Abram and the angels and Tobit is very hospitable, right? And St. Peter tells us to practice hospitality. And he doesn't say if you're good with it. He doesn't say practice hospitality if you're not anxious. Mm-hmm. He says practice hospitality. Okay. So when we designed our home, we designed it with a guest suite where you know, it looks like a monastic hallway, and there's a, you know, down that hallway is your own, it's your own hallway. And you have a, you know, guest suite with its own master bath in it, so that people can come stay here. And it's not because of us, but because of what we've created intentionally, okay, to give people a place where they feel peace and rest. So, you know, my sister was just here with her husband this past weekend, and she says, I haven't slept this well in a year, and I don't sleep this well until I come to your house because it's quiet and it's warm. And, you know, how many times have we seen in scripture when somebody visits, you know, the person gives of what they have, you know? So I think that you have to be willing to do that, even if it's uncomfortable. Give of your food and there'll always be more. There'll always be enough. If you give of what you have, there'll always be enough. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, when we've had people come from other states that were Twitter mutuals just to visit us on the farm because they've seen pictures and they want to come out and see it. And I think that if they're coming from that far, you owe them, you know, to be generous and hospitable, so that they can, they're not going to pay you back. Mm-hmm. You're not doing this for any of your gain. Okay. Right. But hopefully then other people will say, well, I want to do that for other people. You know, I want to host people that mm-hmm. come through. Okay. Mm-hmm. Make your home a welcome place for others. Can I grab a book here real quickly to read you something?
Okay. Absolutely.
Hold on.
Yeah. I'm a man who loves books. So anytime I have opportunity to find another book to buy, I'm typically not one to.
Sorry, I stepped down.
No, that's all right.
Okay. So my favorite passage from G.K. Chesterton is the closing to his book, Charles Dickens. Okay. And I'll read you this paragraph. And this is kind of, It's a challenge and an indictment at the same time. It's a challenge to do it, and it's an indictment if you don't.
Okay.
He says, the hour of absinthe is over. We shall not be further troubled with the little artists who found Dickens too sane for their sorrows and too clean for their delights. But we have a long way to travel before we get back to what Dickens meant. And the passage is along a rambling English road, a twisting road, such as Mr. Pickwick traveled. But this, at least, is part of what he meant, that comradeship and serious joy are not interludes in our travel, but rather our travels are interludes in comradeship and joy, which through God shall endure forever. The inn does not point to the road. All roads point to the inn. And all roads point at last to an ultimate inn, where we shall meet Dickens and all of his characters. And when we drink, it shall be from the great flagons in the tavern at the end of the world. And I read that a long, long time ago. And I want our home to be the inn at the end of the road for people whether it's our kids. So we designed the home so that our kids and their families, long before they had families, mm-hmm. could all have space here. You know, big rooms with that can have, you know, so now the upstairs rooms have a queen bed, a twin bed, and futons that fold out in them. And we're getting more fold out futons as the grandkids keep multiplying. Okay.
Build it and they will come.
Yeah. And that's the whole thing. When you have a traveler's rest and inn with a warm fire, people want to come. Okay. Yeah. And that can't help but be to preach the gospel every day with words if necessary. Right. And so that's what localism can do. It can bring us closer to one another. And in the community, we can see how God is a community, right? Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. We can see that in each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm. One other thing that I really wanted to talk about with you, Tom, is mentorship. I mean, I think that, and this has some underlying aspects of what we've already talked about with even hospitality, with what you just shared, you know, building out your home so that you have your family to welcome back, as a dad. And then, you know, as hopefully someday, God willing, be a grandfather, you know, there's this need for mentorship, for young men. And a lot of times men don't have it. I mean, we were actually even talking about how a lot of people don't even experience the love of a father anymore. And so how are they going to experience the love of God the Father if they don't even have a natural version of understanding what fatherly love is? And so what role does mentorship play, and how do we cultivate, how do we bring that back?
Well, first of all, mentorship has to be something that's deliberate. It's not accidental, and it's not a one-time thing. It's not a talk that you give to somebody. Okay. Mentorship comes from a relationship. Okay. Mm-hmm. And do you know where the word mentor comes from?
Yes. It's from the great books.
It's from the Iliad. Mentor was who Odysseus left his son to be,
right,
be cared by when he went off to fight in the Trojan War. And so we have to be careful how we use that term. When we tell, for example, Middle Easterners that I'm here to mentor you, they take that in as if they're the child and you are mentor. Okay, because that's where mm-hmm. the word comes from. Okay, in the modern Western tradition, we see that as a relationship where somebody with wisdom is passing that on, but it's not a one-time thing. And so it has to be deliberate. So first of all, it has to be sought after, and it cannot be imposed. So I will never call somebody up and say, "Hey, I am going to be your mentor." Okay. Mm-hmm. First of all, I'm not going to do that. I don't have time to, I'm not here to stroke myself and make myself feel good about myself, about being somebody's mentor. On the other hand, when somebody calls, the answer is always yes. Okay. You gotta be there and be available. And so what I ask when somebody calls me and says, "Hey, would you mentor me?" It's always, what is it that you want? What is it that you're seeking? How can I help you get that? It's never, "Sure, I'll mentor you and create a mini me, a clone of myself," because that's not what mentoring is. Okay. It's how do you get that person to achieve his or her goals? And I'll always want to know what that is, because I don't want to participate in something that's not good and wholesome. So I'm not going to help somebody achieve their goals if they're not rightly ordered.
Sure.
Okay. And so you start out by getting to know the person and then by helping steer them. What is it that you want in your career? What is it that you want out of life? How can I help you with that? And, you know, if you really want to mentor somebody, be available. Okay. So people have to know that you're out there. I get a, I got a call probably 8 years ago from somebody that I didn't know that said, hey, I was putting out the word that, for mentors, and your name came up from two different people that didn't know each other in two different conversations. And they both told me to call you. So I'm calling you. So first of all, if you, Adam, want to be somebody's mentor or want to be available as a mentor, which I really urge you to do, that you should, let people know that you're out there. Let people know that you're available, or that you will hook them up with the right person. Okay. You can be the middleman. You don't necessarily have to be the mentor. I think that that's a very important thing to do as well. I have told people, listen, you and I may not be the right fit, but I think that maybe I'll find somebody that is the right fit for you. Okay.
Yeah. So I find that what you're talking about, the overlap, you said off camera, you said how much you like Venn diagrams, which I do too. I'm a man who enjoys Venn diagrams. And I find that mentorship and discipleship have a very big overlap, mm-hmm. In the way that you're talking about, not the way, you know, that we were talking, that you were saying with the Iliad, the mentorship with father and child, which it's not exclusive to that, but there's a lot of discipleship and mentorship overlap.
Yeah, I agree. So I'm watching. So my son is a Focus missionary, he and his wife, and as a family, they're great. They do great discipleship. Nick and Alex, they're very, very deliberate in their discipleship. And he's really an evangelization machine. I mean, he really, really is. Mm-hmm. There are some young men that there's a difference, a sufficient age difference with which he could be a mentor to some of them right now, but most of them it's discipleship. Okay. But he's growing into that point where he's going to be a good mentor. Okay. Mm-hmm. I see, two of my sons-in-law, husbands to two of my daughters are very, very good bosses, and they're growing into that point where they're going to be very good mentors to some young men as well.
And I think that's something that as Christians, we really need to think about, you know, who is it that I'm discipling, and who is that I am being discipled by?
Yes. Who am I open to being discipled by and being mentored by?
Right.
I'm 61 and I'm still looking for mentorship.
Yeah. I mean, we're never too old to learn. We're never too, you know, we're in this life. We're called to the life of holiness. Right. And so if you're not increasing in the low of Christ, you're stagnant is not the way you want to be as a Christian, mm-hmm. you know, cause that's typically not growth. Being stagnant is not growth. So yeah, I think that's really good to really consider as we think about evangelization is who am I being mentored by and who am I mentoring? Who am I discipling?
Who am I open? Am I humble enough to accept, you know, mentoring? Humility, I think, is the queen of virtues.
Of course, yeah.
And am I willing to give of myself enough to mentor somebody else? To be there, be intentional for somebody else.
Yeah. Man, Tom, I've had a blast talking with you. We'll have to definitely do it again. How do people find you? How can people look you up on online or where can they follow you guys?
So I have a consultancy, a business consultancy called Bluegrass Critical Thinking Solutions. So that's bgcts.com. You can find me at bluegrasscriticalthinkingsolutions.com or bgcts.com. I'm at bgcts on Twitter, X. My contact information is on my website. It's really easy to find. You can read 12 years worth of articles, and then I've got links to academic pieces that I've written over my career. You can find out a little bit about me. If you write to me, I will answer you. If you call me, I will get back to you. And that's a promise. And I just really dig what you're doing. I would love to get out to Tulsa and see you sometime. I would love to have you come out here and visit me. I'd love for you to come hunt with me sometime. I'd love for you to come walk in the woods, bring your kids out here to break geodes open.
Yeah, that would be a blast. You're always welcome in Tulsa. And man, let me tell you, there's people who keep finding out online how awesome of a Catholic culture we have out here.
Yeah, you really do. You've got a great little spot in time, and we have to appreciate those because they come and go. You know, there have been,
of course, yeah.
There are dioceses that no longer exist anymore that were once what Tulsa is today. And you have to make the most of it in the time that we have, because we only have the time that we're given here. So
that's right. Yeah.
God bless you, Betty. I'm really proud of you. I just it's been
an honor. And, again, I'm very grateful for you reaching out and very grateful for your conversation and, learning from you, and we'll do it again.
Okay. Peace.